Hey everyone, it's Thanos, and welcome back to 2019's first podcast episode of The Greek Current. This week we're joined by Andy Zemanidis here at HALC headquarters.
I'm back.
And from Greece calling in, Tom Ellis, the editor of Kathimerini English Edition. Tom, welcome to The Greek Current again.
Thank you.
You've been on before for our listeners that have been following since the beginning.
Sure.
For those of you who don't know
and
who he is.
And he's kind of my boss now, right? Because I have
the bi-weekly
Transatlantic Insight column.
Yeah, so head to Kathimerini English Edition. You can read Andy's musings on the world there. For those of you who aren't familiar with Tom's work, as I said, he's the editor of Kathimerini English Edition. He's been covering developments in Athens over the name deal with Fyrom, the recent visit by Prime Minister Tsipras to Turkey, and the broader political climate in Greece, all things that we're going to cover on this episode. So, Tom, it's been a roller coaster start to the year in Greece, to say the least. And I want to start off with the biggest development, I think, in Greek foreign policy in decades, and that's the ratification of the Prespis Agreement by the Greek Parliament in January. That deal was hotly debated and obviously filled with political drama, the entire process. Walk us through a little bit how it played out.
Well, I mean, it was a big deal. I mean, it was more than almost 30 years. So, and I remember covering the beginning of the crisis, if one can call it that, in 1992. We went through ups and downs. The thing is, to make the long story short, that the governments of Tsipras and Zaev ended up with a compromise. Main thing was the name, which now will be North Macedonia. It's a policy that Greece, in the last 12, 13 years, in reality, during the whole period, but officially during the last 13 years, has followed, meaning it was looking for a composite name with a geographic qualifier, which would be used by everybody, and that's the case with North Macedonia. So in that sense, it's a good deal. The maximum, the best solution would be with no Macedonia in there, but everybody knows, who is a realist, in the last three decades, that you would end up with something including Macedonia. The big debate in Greece was, and there was a big division, unfortunately, was that part of the agreement says that their identity is Macedonian. Now, identity is what New Democracy and the critics of the agreement call it. The agreement talks about nationality. One can see that as identity. He or she can also interpret nationality as citizenship. So depends where you want to stand. I assume our neighbors to the north will talk about their nationality and as an identity. People from this side of the border would or should call that the citizenship. Whatever the case, that's something that the other side won. It's, for my taste, an honorable compromise, not the greatest agreement one would have liked, but given the circumstances over the last three decades, I think it's an agreement that Greece can live with. Plus, it puts Greece in a position of being part of a solution to a regional problem instead of being part of problems, as we are seeing in Brussels and Washington. Not necessarily being the problem, but even with Cyprus, and it's not our fault, but you know better than I do that people who deal with Greece know that, oh, they have a neighbor to the north, they have an issue, then they have a neighbor to the east, they have an issue, then they have Cyprus. And so the less problems you have, the better for you as a country. In that sense, it was a good deal. And Brussels and Washington, and especially the Europeans and NATO, have welcomed the agreement. And actually, in a couple of days, on the weekend in Munich, the two prime ministers, Tsipras and Zaev, will get an award during the Munich Security Conference, which is a big deal every year. And they will get an award for promoting peace and stability in the region. So in that sense, we are over and done with. Now that everything has been ratified, the next steps, and actually by next I mean like tomorrow, we expect to see the change of names on signs, on streets, and as I understand it, it's a matter of hours or maybe a day or so that this process will start. So as we have, as we see these changes, at the same time we see different countries in NATO ratifying the agreement, and we'll move on. And at the end of the day, Fyrom will be North Macedonia, will be part of NATO. And to connect this to our relationship with Turkey, which all of us know is, you know, an existential issue for us, and it's the major national issue for both Greece and Cyprus, the agreement with North Macedonia is also helpful in my view, because it, not that it stops any Turkish influence, but at least it helps Greece have its own commercial and political and social ties, which is always helpful. Whatever President Erdogan does, it's easier if we are there also with companies, with tourism. So in that sense, it also helps in the wider regional context from a Greek perspective.
Tom, you know, you had a obviously unique perspective because, like you said, when you started covering the PRESPA agreement when it was unveiled, you had, I think, a very telling critique that about the political motivations by the government, that even though it may be an honorable compromise, they could have built consensus around it. And, you know, it seems that this problem, the Macedonian issue for years, has been treated more like a domestic political issue rather than a national issue. What have we learned from PRESPA, from the 30 years, that will be useful and that we should adjust in terms of approach on national issues in the Aegean, on Cyprus, in, you know, with Albania? Albania's next up.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, the lesson here is not good, because as you mentioned, I wrote a few columns, and actually, as I really feel as a Greek, you know, abroad, as somebody who doesn't care about which party's in power, which is not the case with most of my colleagues, and I say that with respect, because it's understandable. If you're in the country, you tend to be with one side or the other. Everybody has an ideological point of view, but if you live in the States or in Australia or whatever, you tend to want Greece to move forward. You know, whoever the prime minister, you don't care that much, as long as, you know, they are democratically elected, and then they do good things. So my criticism was that Tsipras, who indeed has shown leadership in this effort with the PRESPA agreement, he could have tried to work with Mitsotakis. I mean, I think deep down Mitsotakis would support the substance of the agreement. He could, you know, still be critical on some points. It's healthy. It sometimes helps the government to tell the international community, I'm doing a deal, but my opposition is also criticizing me on some points. But they could have worked, you know, in private and create a unified Greek position. They did not. And here I think the main, although as I said, Tsipras is on the right side, I think, of the issue, but he cynically tried to divide New Democracy, which has, in a way, you know, half, let's say in general, like half of the party would look into the agreement in a positive way, and half was totally opposed to it. So they felt, oh, this is the Syriza party felt they could create divisions within New Democracy. So in that sense, we did not, here we don't have an example of a unifying approach, a united approach, which we need on so many issues, including Cyprus and the Aegean. I hope we will have it. And actually, to be honest, as I mentioned before, with the signs, the North Macedonia signs, this, in the next few days, there's another chance. There's a second round, if I can use the word, that Mitsotakis can go out and say, you know what, to the international community, I was against the agreement, but I think North Macedonia is better than just Macedonia. So I'm pushing, or I'm putting my weight behind the use, universal use of North Macedonia. I still keep my criticism of the identity and nationality part, but on the name, which I think is better than Macedonia, I call upon these center-right parties in Europe, I call upon the Greek-American community to push the U.S. government or the Europeans and others to use North Macedonia. So that might be a good example of unifying the two forces, meaning Syriza and New Democracy, but that remains to be seen. Now, moving to Turkey and Cyprus, we had, you know, the visit by Prime Minister Tsipras to Turkey.
Before we touch on the Tsipras visit, sure. I just had one final question on the Macedonia name deal. You published today in Kathimerini, in the comment section, an article titled, "Did Greece Win the Name Dispute? Should It?" Mm-hmm. What's your response to that, or your answer?
Well, here, and it's a very sensitive issue, and I respect both sides of the issue here, and I say that sincerely. You know, we grew up feeling that there's no other Macedonia. In that sense, I cannot criticize somebody who is Greek and feels that we lost part of the name. But if you're a realist, I think when you're faced with 190 countries feeling or thinking you are crazy, then it's much better to get a deal, be it a compromise and a painful one, okay, but it's better than what you had before. So in that sense, do you call this a win? Do you call this a loss? I think it's a painful move forward.
So, and the move forward was almost immediate as the prime minister went to Turkey. You kind of threw up some red flags right away about being careful, about being bold. Mm-hmm. Your comment about, and you've been consistently critical about the need or the lack of building national consensus. It kind of looked like the trip to Turkey was a whole lot of nothing. There were some great photo ops, especially of Prime Minister Tsipras going to Halki. But what's your assessment of the trip to Turkey, the need for it, and what came out of it?
Not a huge deal. I mean, you know, it's always a delicate situation, and it's even more sensitive with this situation with the eight Turkish servicemen who Erdogan feels or are accused of being part of the plot to overthrow him. So,
well, Erdogan basically issued a bounty for them before the trip began.
Yeah. Yeah, which was not, the most polite thing to do. But in substance,
to put it diplomatically.
Yeah. One thing no one knows is the fact, or we do know, that the two leaders spent 2 hours together, which is a lot. Of course, you need the translation, so one could, you know, talk about an hour and a few minutes, but still, it's a lot. So if we don't know what they talked about, and not even the diplomatic advisors were present, so we don't know. The thing is that it's not, as I've written, I don't think it's the best time to make any bold moves, and I would have suspect, and it's understandable on a human level, if you are Tsipras and you get congratulations from leaders from all over the world about the Prespas agreement, and you feel you're solving issues, and here you are doing things and being awarded whatever. Why not try to solve, quote-unquote, Greek-Turkish problems or the Cyprus issue, which is great. I mean, if you can do it, yeah. But does this mean that you solve it in any way Erdogan wants? If that's the case, of course, it's not something you should do. And I just hoped, and I noted repeatedly, that he, meaning the Greek prime minister, doesn't fall into the trap of solving, quote-unquote, issues. But again, if they spent 2 hours together, I'm sure they talked about substance. There's no way they were just, symbols. Yeah. Now, the issues in the Aegean, we do have the talks that have been going on for many years, and with the territorial waters, and there I know from our diplomats that a lot of progress has been made, and there are some compromises that could take place and could be enforced. I don't know if the two sides are ready politically, but a lot of groundwork has been done. Another dimension is the fact that we don't have Kamenos there anymore as the defense minister, and he was somebody that the Turks really were upset about. He was sometimes a little bit too, how should I call him? He was
flamboyant.
A Greek defense minister. Yeah, flamboyant. That's a nice word, nice approach. Now with the two defense ministers being former heads of, former chiefs of staff, they will meet, I think, not tomorrow, the day after, in Brussels, within the context of the NATO defense ministers summit or meeting. And there we'll see. There might be, sometimes military people, although we think of generals as harsh or whatever, or very war, that they like war or whatever. I think at the end of the day, they end up being the people who want to keep the peace because they've seen war. So we might have something there. I'm not sure, but we'll see. But the main issue is Cyprus. And in Cyprus, the situation has become even more complicated because of the gas reserves, which makes it, if money is involved, and a lot of money is involved, it makes the whole temperature go up. How far will Erdogan move there, and how will the alliances with Israel, but also Egypt, stand and hold with Cyprus and Greece?
And Exxon, because Exxon is like a mini-state, and the
Exxon, but also Total. Of course, the example of Eni, the Italian company, is not something that we should be glad about, but everybody tells me, and again, I'm not an expert on that, but everybody makes a differentiation between the Italians and then, of course, the Americans, but also the French, that they are different countries, different military mights, and different approaches, and that both Washington and Paris will stand by their companies, Exxon and Total, respectively, remains to be seen. I assume they will. But if a lot of gas is found, which again remains to be seen, we are still in the hopeful phase, but not something really certain. There might be carrots for the other side. I mean, of course, no one can call Erdogan somebody who is dependable or rational or whatever. But I would expect the rational leader in Ankara to try to take advantage of the situation. I mean, I would give in, to be honest. It sounds a little cynical, but, if I were in his position, I would give in on some aspects of the Cyprus issue, which I don't think it's giving in from our side, but I'm talking about him, to be able to be part of this grand scheme. And why lose that because of some details or having troops on the island, which for me is crazy. I think it's crazy for any rational person in the world. And to be honest, as I tell my Turkish friends, I mean, even if you're really worried, you don't need troops on the island. You're too close. So get your troops out. Allow the process to move ahead. Make some compromises to allow for a workable solution. You are there. I mean, not that they will intervene ever, I hope. But don't stop the progress and let it move forward in order for you to not be excluded from the whole package. Although all this approach might be totally theoretical, because given what Erdogan is doing with the U.S. and how he's getting close to Russia and goes back and forth, all this analysis might be groundless, because if he's not in the Western camp or doesn't use U.S. weapons or whatever, then he might be out of the whole scheme by his own decision. He might opt for a different approach, which will in one way allow Greece and Cyprus to move forward more easily with their alliances regionally, I mean, with Israel and Egypt, and then, of course, the commercial aspect of drilling and taking advantage of the gas in the area would be our issue, and Turkey would have no say. But I'm a little bit going, you know.
Well, you use some terminology that I think is key, where you said grand scheme, and it's mm-hmm. not only about the gas and, frankly, oil. At the end of last week, it was leaked that Exxon found commercially viable oil, which I'm really looking forward. And Tom, I think Gathimerini, we should go get the rights to film the Beverly Hillbillies in Cyprus. But you know, there was another major development that you reported on just a week prior. And that was the first annual Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum, which aims to be kind of like an OPEC for the region. It was hosted in Egypt, right? Mm-hmm. Greece, Cyprus, Israel. The Palestinians were there. Mm-hmm. Jordan mm-hmm. was there. Italy was there. And it was kind of made clear that there's space for Turkey to be at that table, but Turkey has to play by the rules.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, I think these developments are important to note, because it's not going to be, you know, Greece and Cyprus and Israel versus Turkey, right? Nobody wants that fight. But for the first time, it looks like the international community, because of these new structures and these new developments, are putting conditions on Turkey. You know, you're not getting that blank check anymore. You're not getting that blank check on the F-35s anymore. And the F-35s are going to become, once again, an issue before this Congress. And Congress, you know, giving the State Department the leeway to try to kill the S-400 deal, but is making it clear that there is no universe in which they will accept both S-400s and F-35s in Turkey. And this is where diplomatic leverage, right? I think going to the beginning of your podcast today, of your comments even on the PRESPA agreement and your commentary in the newspaper, this is where diplomatic leverage becomes a key, because it's not Turkey can't only decide between the West and Russia. It almost has to decide between the West and the Levant, including Arab states, because Greece is in the middle of all these trilaterals. And if Greece can really not only, you know, establish good relationships with the soon-to-be North Macedonia, but really stabilize its relationship with Albania, create an axis up through Serbia, and play the role that up until just recently Istanbul was playing, where everybody from the Balkans, from Central Asia, from all the way to the Persian Gulf was coming to Istanbul to talk. You know, Stephen Cook and the Council on Foreign Relations says, well, maybe Athens can play that role, because nobody is going to go to Istanbul to get along nowadays. So
some of them might have arrest warrants. You know, this is
a real, you know, key diplomatic period for Greece, and I'm not sure I'm not sure we're set up to take advantage of it, and whether, you know, the domestic political constituency in Greece, or even some of the diaspora, is thinking in the right way.
You know, I would tend to say that, going back in a way to one of the first questions about us in Greece working, I mean, the different parties working together, having a unifying position, whatever. In this case, especially with Israel, but also with Egypt, it's one of the rare cases, to be honest, because I've been writing about good relations with Israel for so many reasons, from the fact that they are a democracy to the diaspora in the U.S. working together, and so many other reasons. And I see the fact that we saw the fact that George Papandreou began in 2010 this opening, and then Adonis Samaras continued, and then Tsipras continued. And actually, the Israelis were thrilled with Papandreou. They expected Samaras to continue, and they were happy that he did. But they were really concerned with Tsipras. They were, you know, he was his radical positions in the past were something to be worried about. But at the end of the day, he continued and even deepened the relationship. So now I assume the Israelis know that, that this is a strategic decision of Greece. And of course, Cyprus is on the right track here. So this axis of Greece and Cyprus is working. And I assume with any government in both Nicosia and Athens, we'll see this continue. And this allows for a good, close relationship with the diaspora, especially in the U.S., but in other countries also. The diaspora, like a lot of people I knew and I know in Washington and New York, at least, and Chicago, I assume, have been supportive of that for many years. So on that level, let's call it the East Med policy of both Athens and Nicosia, I think we can be, I don't know if proud is the right word, but I think that we are on a good, you know, good track. I mean, there, one should not, you know, call it perfect. We always can improve, but I think we are moving on the right direction. So, and here is very helpful because both the Israelis and the Egyptians are looking to Cyprus and, you know, a little bit more given the size, to Greece, as a gateway to the European Union. So it's not only the two countries, which are markets, which have you know, things to offer, but they are also part of the European Union. So for commercial reasons, and this is not confined to oil or gas, it's even for normal, you know, different products, Greece and Cyprus can and do play the role of some kind of bridge for Egypt, and which is a big country in the Muslim world, and of course Israel. So, as I said before, I think that, you know, on that level we are doing relatively well, and that's a modest assessment.
Tom, we've talked about these major news items that have hit us back to back in 2019 alone, and it's only, you know, February 11th today that we're recording. But there's one piece of news that we haven't touched on yet that I want to wrap up the podcast with. And it's one that not only impacts Greece, but all of Hellenism and the Greek diaspora. And that's the recent passing of Halyk's founder, Nikos Mouyaris. Obviously, his passing has left Hellenes in the around the world, and especially in the U.S., with a lot of important questions to reflect on, particularly about how we want our future, the future of our diaspora to look. And as we mentioned, you've had the opportunity to report from the States in the past, and you've seen the changes in the organized diaspora over the years. So I'd like your take.
And he was personally close to Nikos.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, look, tell Nikos, us about, I mean, the legacy. Yeah, that
yeah, Nikos, you know, we are used to always say good things about people who have left us, and that's normal, you know. But this is one of these cases that you have somebody who was successful in what he did, you know, business-wise, and he really cared, and he pushed for unity, and he also had fights with other how should I call them, you know, big guys of the community, and in a good sense, saying, you know, we all have money, why don't we put $10 million each to do this, or why don't we, you know, create organizations. And he also was critical of the church, which is not an easy thing. I mean, and of course, on a human level, you know, he was a nice person, giving. He did so many things, and actually, he did more, much more than we know, which is what, you know, Nikos was all about. Now, at the end of the day, I think what we will remember will be the Hellenic American Leadership Council. And I'm not saying that because of Andy. I'm saying that because of Nikos. Because, with all due respect to Andy, on that podcast, let me emphasize Nikos. Because Nikos, not only was he, you know, the heart behind it, and not only the heart, but the soul, let's put it that way. But he was an example larger than just one organization. He was trying to make a difference. And the message was that let's get together, one. Then let's go to the young people. Let's connect with other communities, mainly the Jewish community in the U.S., but not only them, but that's the, you know, first thing that comes to mind. And then he wanted to help Greece. I remember so many times saying, you know, well, let's go and invest. And it's not only putting, you know, 50 million. It's like the saying which goes, you know, you don't help somebody by somebody who is hungry giving him fish. You better teach him how to fish, make him a fisherman or whatever, be able to fish by himself. And that was, if I can say, the substance of his message, that let's help Greeks and Cypriots to take advantage of their countries and their, you know, tourism or bio, how you call it?
Agriculture.
Agriculture, yeah, all that, so many different
aspects. And human capital.
Human capital, and he was putting his money where his mouth was. He, you know, I have met so many, and I'm saying that with respect, but I'm a little bit, you know, upset about that. I've met so many well-off Greek Americans who say so many good things and right things, but then they don't, you know, they don't do things. Nikos was not only saying things, but doing things. And it's a pity because he was young, you know. I mean, sometimes you look back, not that it's nice to pass away, you know, if you're older, but I mean, he had many years for him, for us, for the community to offer. And it's really a pity that he left us. And I don't know, I remember it, Vraka years, you know, yeah, when he was supporting different candidates, and then in Avra, in Manhattan, where he would have his own little table and talk about what we can do and how we can help and what do you think, what should I do, you know. That was the whole, it would have been, with most other people, it would be 90% stupid things and then maybe some questions about politics or what we could do. With Nico, it was always, you know, if I do that and if I go down and create this industry in Greece, will it work? And, you know, if 100 people find a job, would that be enough? I mean, that was his concern, and that was real concern, and that's one of the differences. I mean,
he
thought
detailed,
he cared, and he did. He did things. Yeah.
And real detailed planning. And those of you who listen to this and participate in the Halk universe, you know, you're very much part of Nikos's legacy. There's, you know, as Tom said, there are a lot of great plans in this community, and there are a lot of people who think they're visionaries because they think of a great idea. But Nikos, there's a saying, something that Thomas Edison once said, that, you know, having a vision for what you want is not enough. Vision without execution is hallucination. And you know, and it's not only that Nico funded a lot of institutions. He studied and talked and considered and was a deep thinker on everything he put his support behind. He planned for HALC for a long time before it was launched. He talked to Tom about a lot of things. He talked to Ignatiu and he talked to elected leaders, and he knew in detail what he was doing, and he carefully considered what he was investing in and what he expected of us. And I'm not only talking about staff here at HALC, the members of HALC. He knew, unfortunately, as Tom said, you know, he had a lot to give. He was at a high, and we lost him far too early. But Nikos knew that it wasn't enough to act, and especially because he very often acted alone. He knew leadership required inspiring and enabling others to act. And, you know, those of you who are listening today are listening because he helped set up this infrastructure. This infrastructure was not available, minus Nikos Mouliaris. Now we have a responsibility. We've been inspired by him. We've been enabled by him. Now we have to carry on and make his vision and his imagination a reality. And part of that is staying informed. So we thank you for listening to this. We urge you to, you know, we've had Tom on before, and we send out, you know, news items from Kathimerini. But if you're not informed, that was the one thing about Nikos. He was more informed than anybody, maybe than all of us combined. It's really, Tom, you know, it's really a special privilege not only to be able to read your stuff, but that you join us and give us this insight, because a proper diaspora, a diaspora that can make a difference, has to start with an informed diaspora. So, you know, we're happy. We're thrilled and honored that you join us. We're going to keep this contact going and keep up the good work with Kathimerini and Kathimerini English.
Thanks, guys. And as I said, deeds, not just words. I mean, we use words in the paper, of course, but the message from Nikos, but just even broader than that, is good thoughts have to be, you need actions. I mean, words are not enough. So that goes for so many other reasons. I mean, for the national issues, for Cyprus, for Greece, and for the community itself, not only for the national issues, but we have to be more successful. I mean, we are successful, and we should be proud of that. But we need the next Dukakis's and the next Sarbanes's, and we're working on that level, and I'm sure HALC will contribute even more to have an even more stronger presence in the political and economic life of the U.S.
Thanks again, Tom, for joining us.
Thank you.
This wraps up this week's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.